Well, I'm very, very glad to be here, and I'm very glad to see all of you here. We have arrived in Scientology at a point where man should have been the last 5,000 years. The history of man, is studded with a number of errors. I think if you look it over, you'll find that there are quite a few errors on his track. And I think you'll also discover that each and every one of these errors is due to the fact that he did not understand himself. One might say that man made these errors because he was seeking to understand himself. And in seeking to understand himself, he excluded the rest of the world out. Most of the philosophic searches which have gone on in man's history have been quite interesting. Interestingly, on the first dynamic, individuals looked into their own cranium, saw a bunch of neurons busy snapsing, and said, ah, that is what the world is like. And didn't bother to look over at their next door neighbor and discover that he was looking into a cranium full of neurons that were going synapse. He didn't bother. So he invented gunpowder. Before that, he invented catapults, Greek fire. Before that, why, he invented pebbles and stone axes. Now, what forced man to invent all these things? That's an interesting thing. Why did he go to all the trouble of inventing a catapult? Did you ever see a replica of a catapult in a museum? Of course, I won't ask you if you've ever pushed a catapult. But have you ever seen one of these huge wheeled contrivances with its enormous arms and springs and so forth? This is quite a fantastic instrument, a catapult. It was the high point of Roman warfare. The roads which we travel on today right here in London have 9-foot roadbeds. They're 9 feet deep, simply so that somebody could run a catapult over them. So we can't say the catapult was entirely a dead loss. The buses don't bump as badly as they would while going around Oxford Circus. And so man did make history with his catapult. Now, when it comes down to looking over this amount of effort, that amount of hugeness, that amount of ingenuity, I wonder if he put as much time in on trying to understand his fellows, if he wouldn't have found it unnecessary. But he did evidently find it necessary. He built a catapult and he went around to do what? To batter down the citadels of other cities and nations. He wanted to batter down their walls, crash through. To do what? So he could meet somebody. Well, now you figure it out. He was on the right track, but he was doing it rather crudely. He was on the right track. He did know there was somebody inside. And he went at it the best way he knew how, with a catapult. Now, this survives into modern times. The mathematics of James Clerk Maxwell, the various contrivances that people built, wet batteries, you know, and back in the old times, and made frogs' legs jump and so on, and which today are running huge plants and industries and producing things and helping man out in all directions. That, too, has become the modern catapult. What's done with that? Well, they use electricity today to batter in somebody's skull. So they can do what? So they can meet somebody. Now, it's obvious that this must have some point to it. In other words, the electric shock as used in psychotherapy must be some kind of an effort to batter something down. So whether we're using ancient weapons or modern scientific developments, apparently the goal is just about the same as it was. That is, if you can throw enough stuff, if you can hit hard enough against an obstacle, if you can press home far enough, man is evidently convinced that you will meet somebody. And in Scientology, without any such extraordinary measures, we have finally met somebody. Now, man's relentless search was, where is he? His search, which has continued over Lord knows what length of time, has consisted of simply this. Where is he? And what is he doing? And what is he going to do? Always the other fellow. What is he going to do? Where is he? What does he consist of? Now, the most preposterous theories have been evolved by man to answer these questions. There is no theory that you at this moment, I'm sure, could think of that has not been advanced as a solemn scientific theory. Just think of a silly theory about life. All life is in canned vegetables. You know, anything like that. Well, that's been seriously advanced. I'm sure of it. The facts of the case are very, very elementary. What he was looking for was evidently not easily discoverable because he didn't think he'd found anything unless he could see it. And what he was looking for was invisible, a thetan. It's very interesting, his search for this final goal. Rather amusing when you look over the extraordinary efforts, the huge universities, the enormous monasteries, and the great, gigantic, illumined tomes which have been written just to avoid answering the question of where is he and what is he going to do. It's fantastic. If you put everything together that had been written or inscribed on the subject of man, what is he, and where is he going to, together of the last 2,000 years, it's very possible that Earth would kind of start to wobble. It'd be top-heavy in one spot where you'd piled all this up. It's quite a bit. It's quite a bit of stuff. Now, for 2,000 years, he held one of the more interesting ideas. He said that there was such a thing as a human soul. Well, that was pretty close to the truth. Pretty close to the truth. So that went a long way. That went a long way. Then when he tried to use this, however, as a control mechanism, as he did in the auto da fe, and the British nation, by the way, was in very thorough protest against this sort of thing a few hundred years ago. What will that fellow Torquemada do next? Was one of the common questions of the street, you know. British ship would go into Cadiz, and they would suddenly send a flag boat out and haul off all the crew and take them off to a dungeon and put them on racks and make them confess, and then because they'd confess, to make sure that they would go to heaven, why, they would burn them at the stake. It was quite an interesting system they had of exteriorizing people. It's very thorough. You can always exteriorize a thetan by leaving nothing left in which he can be. But when they tried to use this as a control mechanism, this discovery of the spirit, it corroded, and people rather fell away from it. And some people went so far away from it as to completely negate the whole subject, and they went back to battering down the walls of citadels again. But these fellows were battering down the walls of citadels for a very peculiar reason. just to batter down the walls of citadels. They didn't think anybody was there. And our modern curve, you might say, that is with us here today in the world, is there's nobody there. Knock the wall down anyhow. You got the idea. Once they had discovered the soul and then had abused this knowledge with very poor HC, you might say. I think Torquemada ran very bad HC. I looked over some of his records. I had one of his books one time. Quite an interesting book. It was bound in human skin. Naturally. And it's very bad HC. It's all about demon exorcism. And for the life of me, I've been looking around for one of these demons ever since. And I haven't found any of them. I have found Thetans in chains, but I haven't found any demons. And therefore, I think that what we consider a demon must be a Thetan in chains. I think that must be more or less what the combination is. Well, he was trying to exorcise all demons. And we're just trying to exorcise Thetans. Exorcise. Entirely different procedure. Entirely different procedure. But anyway, having done this bad thing, then what was the natural reaction to the world at large? It was this thing of looking for spirits or being a spirit was an interesting game, but it's not so good. You get burned at the local stake. Something bad happens to you. You have to pay tithes to the abbey, which already owns 3/4 of the land, as they did here in England. Some of these people, owned 110% of England. And after they'd owned 100%, when they started owning the other 10%, they fell into the ocean, and they haven't really been back since. Always fatal to do that. Now, when we look over this activity, however, we can see that man sooner or later would negate against it, but one never expected him to negate to such a degree as he did. He finally stopped the search entirely, and this happened at an exact specific date. It happened at Leipzig, Germany, in 1879. The whole thing came to a dull, grinding halt. And psychology, which is the study of the human psyche, which is Greek for spirit, became a study of physiology. Now, many people think I'm just gagging and giving you extraneous data when I say something like that, but the funny part of it is it's absolutely true. It's exactly what happened. A fellow by the name of Wundt, the only Wundt, invented what he called Wundtian psychology. And this was very neat because he used this word psychology. Now, psychology means the study of the spirit. And the totality of Wundtian psychology and all psychology proceeding from that time forward until now, which is taught in Oxford, which is taught in Princeton, which is taught in jail, is totally a physiological study. And each one of their textbooks starts out very glibly and says, well, psychology actually is difficult to define. You really have to know the full history of the subject before you can define psychology. Having thus expertly defined it, they go on and say that psychology does not have anything today to do with the human mind or really even with the spirit. And what it has to do with is the nervous response mechanisms of the body, the physiology of the brain, the number of curlicues you carry around in your skull because you didn't know where else to put them. These mechanisms are the study today of modern psychology. And modern psychology busily got nowhere. You know this as well as I do, just as well as they know it. I mean, we're not throwing mud. I mean, we're just announcing a fact. They didn't go anyplace. You never heard of such preposterousness in your life as comes from that particular quarter. I read a newspaper article the other day, and it said the well child is far more prone to mental illness than the sick one. Because he's more active in the environment, he therefore gets more bumps. So therefore, a sick child is better off mentally than a well one. Well, you make something out of it. I couldn't. Well, anyway, there is this subject. And this subject isn't being mentioned by me out of a desire to kick it out or do something of the sort. It's doing a good enough job doing that itself. We don't have to worry about it. I'm just remarking on this subject as a symptom, as the total negation of the human spirit. Just, we want no more of this human spirit. This sort of thing led us into trouble. So now we're going to invent and study a spiritless individual who consists of neurons, bones, blood, and sinew, and stimulus response mechanisms, but no soul, no thing within it which can rise above its environment and meet circumstances and situations. Oh, what a deadly philosophy. This thing is adjudicated in psychology as being total stimulus response. You show it black, it shows black. You show it shows white. You tell it to jump, it jumps. And what's remarkable is nobody has noticed that these things don't occur. I don't know if you've been trying to handle anybody lately. When you showed him black, he said gray. And when you said jump, he thought you said lope. So what about this stimulus response mechanism? Huh? What about this stimulus response mechanism? Is it? Does it exist? Yes, it does. It exists as a mind. But is it much of a person? Well, it's enough of him to give him some trouble. That's how much it is of a person. Now, what do we do about this? How can we look at this fairly? Well, the best way to look at it, I think, is to realize that man, in his studies over a long period of time, got into very serious trouble by following through the theory of the human spirit. He got into very serious trouble with this. And so he invented a philosophy which would abandon that whole aspect entirely, and which would be a materialistic study, so that he could then go on battering down walls without having to meet anybody. Now, I think that he actually negated against this and did develop this thing called Wundtian psychology and modern psychiatric approach and so forth, mostly because he thought that it would lead to less difficulty rather than to greater triumph. He figured out he'd get in less trouble if he did this. Thetan, that wants to stand out in the open and breast the world, is a pretty brave boy. He's pretty brave. And enough of them had done this and gotten into trouble, so he said, well, we'll pretend that we're not here so thoroughly that we'll not be here at all, and then we won't have to worry about this sort of thing. Now let's look at the nobility of man and draw its curve right along with this same thing. The idea of a better nature, the idea of a nobility, the idea of a high purpose, the idea of being able to override your own troubles. That too must have gotten man into a considerable amount of trouble for him to abandon. Because, to a large degree, he abandoned. In World War I, you still had chaps who would go over the top with a crash, verve and enthusiasm. In World War II, I used to drag up my junior officers out of the lower part of the ship and say, you'll have to stand a watch now, and they would tell me how they were no heroes. Quite remarkable difference. Where was their pride? It didn't exist. Now, we are watching the entire Anglo-American society go by the boards for its lack of pride. Once upon a time, a fellow used to stand up and say, "I'm a Briton," or "I'm an American." And he doesn't do that now. He says, "Well, I'm sorry. I really don't mean to be British. Do I look too awfully American to you?" Get the idea. And he's really not too willing to get in there and make his weight felt. He's not really too willing to be self-sacrificing and noble. You would get a chap off the streets and start talking to him about how self-sacrificing and how noble he ought to conduct himself. He would, to be colloquial, give you the bird. Although once upon a time he would have listened to you very raptly and said, "Well, there's a lot in what you say. I know I ought to really snap into it and get underway." We have then a deterioration of man's better nature, you might say, into a more stimulus response conduct and behavior. And the sciences of the mind have simply followed this curve. They themselves have not dominated the curve. And that is probably the only criticism you could make of psychology. It has not dominated the curve. It has not taken a leadership. It has simply sat back and said, "This is what man currently thinks. He doesn't think he's here at all. We'll agree with him." And somebody would have developed that theory, and it would have gotten popular, whether it had been developed in Leipzig, Germany, or Tokyo, Japan. Whether it had been developed by a fellow by the name of Wundt, or a fellow by the name of Krishnamurti. See, it wouldn't have mattered who had developed this. You still would have had this philosophy extant in the world today and popular. Why? Because when he came up on his spiritual curve, when he started to really mount high into spiritual values centuries and centuries ago, he didn't know enough about it, and he fell on his face. And not knowing enough about it, he could be victimized. His fatality was not being a spiritual being. His fatality was not knowing enough about being. And this was a terrible mistake on his part. He never pushed through. Now, it's odd that he didn't, because in the days when man was far more spiritual, you might say, than he is today, he obviously knew far more about it. But it was left to us in a period when the total popularity was, "We're mud. We're mud. We come from mud. We go back to mud. When we breed, we make some more mud. And the conservation of energy is all about us at all times. And when we get better, we will be better mud." And we had to come along in this period and do the impossible. Go all the way through and find out more about man than man knew when he was a noble spiritual being. Probably nobody in those days was in his head. Why didn't somebody write it down? Why didn't somebody say, "You know, when I am looking at a body down there and running it, when I am handling this sort of a situation, I think so and so and so and so, and I can do so and so and so and so." But nobody did. The nearest writing approach we have to it is some complete and utter nonsense written by a chap who was a hemlock addict, Socrates. Socrates talked all the time about a little demon that sat up someplace and told him what to do. He actually wrote this in his various works. And that's about the only mention we have of this sort of thing in the high philosophic works. Now, once upon a time, a fellow by the name of Gautama Buddha, Siddhartha, over in India and the foothills of Tibet. He did a lot of thinking about this, and he wrote a lot of things down. There were a lot of people followed in his way. But he unfortunately never gave out a method of doing anything. He simply said, all you have to do is conceive mind essence, and there you are. Ever since, the poor devils have been trying to sit still long enough to conceive mind essence, and they're still sitting there. This particular body of truth, by the way, is dwindling in numbers rapidly. It's not a rising new inspiration. It is getting smaller. There are fewer Buddhists in the world today than there were. I guess they left too many of their people sitting there trying to conceive mind essence. Since trying to conceive mind essence would be, we know today, the exactly wrong way to go about it. Now, man's search has really been for himself. But when we say a series of words like that, they become very prone to complete misinterpretation. The spirit of one man, looked at by that man, poses an impossibility. Can a stream look at its water? Can a diamond admire its own glitter? That's the question we'd have to answer. It's not possible. So when we state this, we have to say the individual man's search was really for the spirit of others. And that was the search of an individual man. And as I say, he used catapults. He used all manner of interesting devices, electric shock machines. He used torture chambers. He used fire. All sorts of things, but never standing alongside of somebody expiring during an auto-da-fé, did he see really a spirit ascending on high. If he was there as a recording secretary or something, he said obediently, so I saw his soul go to hell. You know, and that's what he was supposed to say. He didn't observe this at all. So nobody was observing anything, and we were left without exact information on the subject of the other fellow. Now, many people came into Scientology to know more about themselves. They thought. I'll tell you something, just confidentially, just between ourselves. There isn't anything to know about you from your standpoint. There's a bunch of stuff that you dreamed up so that you could thereafter know it. But there is really nothing for you to know about you. Now, the reason I have to tell you that is because this is the oldest mechanism on earth to attract people and interest. Curious about yourself. You must be curious about yourself. You must know yourself better. Work well thyself in order to counsel others clear. This is quite amazing. Since there isn't anything for you to know about yourself. So what does that make a man do? That makes the lake look at its own what? That makes the diamond look at its own sparkle. And when a diamond wishes to see it sparkle, it has to catch a spark going out, grab hold of it, and bring it back and look at it. And when it does that often enough, it, of course, introverts thoroughly. And the perfect, and I do say this, perfect control mechanism, bad control, get everybody down, stamp on everybody, keep the waking class in its place, you know, is you have a lot of advice for other people. Why don't you take some of it yourself? You think that you are competent. Have you ever really looked at what you do? You get the idea. Well, that is the common denominator of all control, which is bad, unknowing control. That is the common denominator of all bad control. Introvert, we say to somebody else. We say, look at yourself. We say, curl back on yourself. Don't reach any of that space, those beams out here. Hold it in. Pull it back. Pull everything into your own chest. Don't outflow. If you catch yourself starting to outflow, you must at once inflow. There you go. See? If at any moment you find yourself being overtly friendly, know there's something wrong with you. If you ever start to outflow in anger, you should realize that that anger belongs against your own breast, not somebody else's. You get the idea? It's every spirit's effort to keep some other spirit from frying down his mess. It's a natural mechanism. If everybody made a complete mess universe, upwards to a couple of hundred people in this room, if each one of us made a messed universe, and then we took these 200 messed universes and superimposed them one on another, and then, without any limitation at all, kept on producing mass, we would, after a while, have something that would look faintly chaotic. It would be interesting, to say the least. 200 messed universes crammed into one, none of them quite fitting. You go down the street and you look at a building, there would actually be 12 buildings there with 12 room plans. Be fascinating. Now, you could conceive a building of being two buildings with two room plans, but how about 200 buildings with 200 room plans all standing on the same space? I doubt anybody could get into the building. So we sort of agree on what the room plan will be for that building, and then we all, like good fellows, use the same doors and don't go mocking up doors of our own and so forth. In other words, we're fairly sociable about the whole thing. And to that degree, we do check ourselves. But now the ordinary concourse of living in this world does require a certain amount of outflow. A certain amount. People are, in essence, required to outflow. If you get on a bus and don't outflow 2.5 pence, you're in trouble. If your boss speaks to you and you don't at least put a particle back in his direction saying, at least if you don't say, it's even that, see? Why, he's liable to say, chop, 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 you know? Yak, 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 yak. He's liable to outflow a lot more. As a matter of fact, he's liable to use his prerogative and privilege to a point of overuse. Now, it's all very well for man to check himself and be social and to live with his fellow man knowingly. He knows he's doing this. He knows he's playing a game. That's perfectly all right for him to do that. As a matter of fact, it won't hurt him a bit. But what if he's doing it unknowingly and doesn't know why he's doing it and actually believes that the reason he's looking into his own eyes and the windows of his own soul is because there's something wrong with him? Well, what if he does it for that reason? What if he feels there's really something he doesn't know about himself? Therefore, he'd better keep a very close watch on himself and his own actions. Well, I'll tell you what, this can go to a degree that he becomes a very sick man. A very sick man. Everybody can have a little bit of this and get along fine. Somebody can start worrying about, I was out there paddling that canoe, and I was talking to this girl, and we were paddling along, and we were doing perfectly all right. And all of a sudden, for some reason or other, I shifted the paddle to the other side and upset the canoe. Must be some reason why I did that. Certainly there's some reason why you did that. Maybe you were tired talking to the girl. But who cares what the reason is? The point is did you handle the situation well from there on? That's what counts. But people won't have you believe that that is what counts. They'll have you believe that what is necessary for you to know is why you upset the canoe at that point. A fellow by the name of Sigmund Freud would have had 8 volumes of answers as to why you upset that canoe. He would tell you all about the paddle and the symbologies of the paddle. The canoe, the symbologies of the canoe. You didn't know all those things. You say, gee, are all these things in my head? Wow. Boy, I'm trickier than I thought, you'd say. But in essence, what is this mechanism of look into yourself, be curious about yourself? It is actually the rather aberrated activity of the other fellow in trying to make you pull back your space, your outflow, your anchor points. In other words, if you make nothing out of yourself, he doesn't have to. Now, it's very simple. Now, supposing a man knew all about himself but didn't know anything about the other fellow. Let's take the final result of self-inspection. What if you knew all about yourself and nothing about the other fellow at all? Didn't know whether he was like you or unlike you. And so on. Well, if you knew all about yourself, you would have had to have had a lot of inventiveness stacked up for you to know about yourself. Don't you see? You would have had to have done a lot of thinkingness and creatingness and reasoningness to know about yourself. But what would you then know about? Would you know about yourself, or would you know about the thinkingness and creativeness of this? Huh? What would be the point here? Just what would you know? Once more, you wouldn't know a thing about yourself. Don't you see? It's a completely pointless search then, isn't it? Now let's say somebody kept hammering and pounding you and saying, why is it that every time you try to kiss me, George, you hiccup? And maybe George is feeling a bit low at that moment, having just missed or something. And he'd say to himself, I wonder why I did that. Because why do I hiccup every time? Do I know anybody else that ever hiccuped? Do I know any girls that hiccuped? Well, every once in a while, he'd catch himself off base on this and suddenly remember that there was somebody who used to hiccup every time they started to kiss him. He remembers this, and he doesn't do that anymore. So he says, this is efficacious to remember this way. I have to know, look at his conclusion now. I have to know more about myself. Was it himself? No, he had to remember somebody else hiccuping before he stopped hiccuping. So he remembered about somebody else, and he doesn't know a bit more about himself than he did before, does he? Well, the various tangles that one gets into in this wise are almost unlimited. One can go on a completely championship self-entanglement of knowing about self. Let me assure you of something. There is something to know about the other fellow. And there isn't anything to know about yourself. I know that sounds funny, but it said, look, now I am myself to the other fellow. Isn't that right? You get real slippy about this, you know. See, I am myself to the other fellow. And he looks at me, and there is something for him to know about me, but there's nothing for me to know about myself. There's something wrong with this whole thing. No, there isn't. There's something for him to know about you, that's for sure. That's certain. There is something for him to know about you. The first thing is you're there. And that he almost never finds out. Well, if you don't know you're there, you need an intensive. If you don't know you're standing talking to the hall porter, you're not talking to the hall porter, so you still don't know anything about yourself. You got it? If you don't know you're there, you're not there. There's this old song, "Where do I go when I'm asleep?" I must go someplace. Why? Why do you have to go someplace? What's the matter? Can't you sleep inside your own head? Now, we look over the various problems arising from these things, and we find that man has depended in the main for his writings on the subject and his learning on the subject upon philosophers. And philosophers are interesting people. They're very interesting people. You can just go on and on about philosophers. You never repeat yourself. Of all of the involvements you've ever read, philosophers have been in all of them. You read about Spinoza. And boy, he certainly wrote an awful lot of stuff. Like a fellow I saw one time was turning over a stack of, a whole set of Spinoza's writings and so forth in my library. They were given to me, and they were very pretty books, and they filled a particularly nice spot there. I had a Ming vase up on one corner of the bookcase, and the backs of these books just exactly matched the color in the Ming vase. So I had these books there. And I was looking them over. I was looking over my books in general, and he came prowling along behind me, and he all of a sudden looked at these books on Spinoza. And he pulled one down, and I was horrified because they'd never been opened, you know, and he might crack the backs. And I said, rather annoyed, "What are you doing?" And he says, I'm looking into this. It's this fellow Spinoza. I've always been hearing about this fellow Spinoza. And I just never had a chance to read anything by Spinoza. So I took the book away from him and opened it a little more carefully to a couple of places where it wouldn't hurt it, and gave it to him. And he sat down and he started reading, and that was the last I saw of him that afternoon. I thought that he'd started reading and kept on reading. He'd started and gone to sleep. Anyway. this fellow Spinoza had an awful lot to say about everything and anything. He had an awful lot to say. But really, the truth of the matter is he was himself a very, very introverted person. He was soul-searching with a vengeance. The only reason I mention him is because he and Tolstoy are probably the championship soul searchers. If there was any labyrinth they had not carved in their own selves by the time they finished their lives, I'm sure they attended to it in their next lives. And so we had, you might say, a fellow on the first dynamic talking about the third dynamic, the other fellow, and also talking about the eighth dynamic of all things. Now, I've written many adventurous things, but I'm here to tell you that I would never sit down and take my pen in hand or my typewriter in lap and start writing on the subject of the Supreme Being. No, I just wouldn't go on and turn out page after page and chapter after chapter on the Supreme Being. I didn't know anything about him. It's probably the only honest statements ever been made on the subject. Now, anyway. I have a very factual attitude. When I don't know about something, I find it safest to say so. Gets you into much less trouble. But here was a fellow who was terribly introverted on the first dynamic himself, being very, very learned on the subject of the eighth dynamic. Well, that's all right, but we look over the rest of these philosophers and we find that they in the main, were tremendously introverted people. They never knew the other man, the other fellow. You take Schopenhauer. I don't know what Schopenhauer was writing about most of the time. Maybe he did. Maybe his works have merely suffered from translation. Let me be charitable. I'm sure that many of the things he said are quite tremendous. Some of the ideas which he had are very fine ideas, the will and the idea. You take somebody that came along, a name you sneeze, you know, Nietzsche? Is a much better point in Philosophers on the First Dynamic. Here was this chap, well, I don't know, he had hay fever and chilblains, and he threw up at the thought of seeing blood. He was quite a boy, you know, puny. Somebody came along one time and tapped Nietzsche on the chest with a forefinger and laid him up in bed with 2 weeks with a broken rib. I mean, it's just about that level. This chap, I hope, is none of your favorite philosophers. He had a lot to say, too. I mean, he was a good poet, but we're talking about him as a philosopher. And what did he write about? What did he write about? What this interesting fellow, Sneezeke, write about? He wrote about the Superman. Now, what the hell would Nietzsche know about a Superman? I think he went toward a war once, and they put him in as a hospital attendant, and he couldn't take it, so they sent him home. And yet we have this man beating some third dynamic chest on the subject of the Superman. Well, now we begin to get a little bit close to home when we talk about Mr. Sneezeke. Thus Spake Zarathustra might have been good poetry, but it was very bad reporting. Very bad reporting. Along came a fellow that had a mustache he never knew how to trim right. Opened up a book of Sneezeke, read it with great expert anger, got a whole country 1-5-ing, overflew Europe, dropped some TNT and explosives on places where that had never been designed to store it. All because what? Because everybody was trying to be Nietzsche's Superman. What a character. So, I'm just pointing out to you, goes just a little bit adrift when he is unable to look at the third dynamic, invents a lot of things to know about himself, and then invents a third dynamic and said, that's what man's like. And man is their trouble. Trouble. Trouble goes the whole way. Every now and then some judge pounds down on some court bench with a gavel and says to some criminal, well, there's something known as Scientology. And those people are over there in such and such a place. And if you'll go over there and get yourself straightened out, I'll suspend your sentence. Every once in a while, some judge does this, completely unheralded, that we know nothing about before that. And some sad, forlorn character, all covered with cinders, having stolen a ride on the railroad or something of the sort, footsore and weary, will walk up to the door and say, here's me. Do something about this. Where'd you come from and what? Well, that's where he came from. Now, this fellow has been shipped in because there's something wrong with him. He doesn't know what's wrong with him. I'll tell you why he doesn't know what's wrong with him. Because there wasn't anything wrong with him. Except that somebody said there was something wrong with him. Got the idea? So we straighten him out, and the only thing we take away from him is the idea that somebody said there was something wrong with him. That's really what we straighten out. Plus this other factor. There is somebody else there. And with every criminal I have ever met, poured in through my front door by some judge that should have known better, has really only had these two things wrong with him. The fact that somebody had said there was something wrong with him, and the fact that he didn't know anybody else was there. And so, of course, he could act as a criminal. There was nobody else present. What does it matter what you do in life if nobody else is alive? If you were out on a huge open plain and you became very vehement, you became very 1-5, and you did this and you did that, who cares? So you went and beat up a rock. Well, it doesn't matter then. Where is social conscience? Where is social responsibility? It doesn't exist. Well, all right. You find out somebody else is there. That other being impresses you with the idea that you are now on your social behavior. And so you try to behave yourself socially. To some degree. You'd probably shoot at him under the existing rules of barbaric warfare. Even that way. You do have behavior toward him, which is different than behavior merely on the subject of rocks and sand and sky. There is a different behavior. But you have to find out somebody else is there. Now, if you have been consistently told that that other fellow is bad, no good, is a dog, doesn't respond, and so forth, what condition do we find at length throughout the whole world? If you've been told that that other individual is never any good, if you've been given the idea that this person is a totally worthless valence or individual, again, what do? You find yourself all alone on a vast plain. You know your intentions are all right, but if everybody else's intentions are all wrong, then you have to act in a peculiar manner toward the rest of human beings. Once more, it's a failure to know the other fellow. What does the other fellow consist of? What is that other fellow? Well, the philosopher had to answer that question. And it's the one question he never answered satisfactorily. And it's the one question that's been answered satisfactorily in Scientology. What does the other fellow consist of? Well, we say he consists of this, 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 and this. Plus, his ideas about other people. He's just a few elementary things, plus his ideas about other people. Which, of course, gives him ideas about himself as another person. In order to have ideas about himself, he has to think of himself as somebody else than whom he is. So it's still ideas about other people, isn't it? So what's wrong with this fellow? It's his ideas about other people. Quite remarkable. You boil it all down, and that's what it is. It's a third dynamic problem we're up against, not a first dynamic problem. Now, the individual, of course, has a great tendency to say that the other fellow is wrong and all bad and this way and that way so that he can have a game, so he can fight and do other interesting things. But the truth of the matter is that he doesn't have to have that much game. Now, the newspapers are specialists in creating false personalities for the public to know about. They create these false personalities. Say, gangsters are this. Teddy boys are that. It's quite remarkable because it's all complete balderdash. They don't consist of that at all. If you took the knowledge you were given in newspapers representing capitalists, socialists, judges, criminals, and you just took those categories, and then you use the newspaper as your only text, and then tried to talk with or do with these people, you would find that there would only be one weapon or one particle you could use in your communications. And that would be a bullet or the large rock thrown by a catapult. If you have an improper idea, if you have an incomplete idea, or a completely erroneous idea of the character of the other fellow, man, woman, or child on earth, then you are actually reduced to the necessity of going out of communication. Now, rather than go entirely out of communication, usually man merely drops to the bullet or slingshot stage. He doesn't go completely out. He starts shooting. He drops down to shooting. Now, it's a funny thing that although we had many friends amongst the Germans in World War II, we did, I mean, as individuals, all of a sudden, the Germans were all mad at us, and we were all mad at the Germans. I think this was quite remarkable. To notice that somebody had been lying to the Germans about the Germans. The Germans were supermen, and everybody else was a louse. Everybody else was a Nietzsche or something. Anyhow, where we had then a broad lie about the other fellow, we had trouble of the magnitude of World War II. And that was enough trouble. I don't want any more trouble like that for quite a while. I saved it all up. I have it, and all the trouble I had, I have it case and threw the case away. And that was more trouble, and I want to have anything to do with a long time, mostly because it wasn't my game. I do other things. I do other things. Lots of things to do. Lots of things to do. You don't have to go out and shoot your fellow human beings. Matter of fact, if you're looking for enemies, why, you don't have to look amongst men at all. You find much more satisfactory enemies elsewhere. Oh, my. And if you run out of those, why, invite an invasion of Martians. You can do almost anything. But the point is that your ideas about the other fellow, to a large degree, monitor your behavior, don't they? Your ideas about yourself really don't monitor your behavior at all. But your ideas about the other fellow monitor your behavior. So what have we learned in Scientology, and what have we attained and achieved after all of these thousands of years of search? We, and by that I mean men, what have we achieved? We have achieved a knowledge of the other fellow. We can state him mathematically, pedantically, simply, correctly, complexly, any other way we want to state it. But most effective for us as Scientologists, we can state it in such a way that he becomes amenable to communication with us. We know enough about him so that we can talk to him. I don't think there are any Scientologists who could not pick out anywhere on Earth a human being and not start the guy talking. I don't think this is possible. Of course, I don't say what the fellow talked to you about, but he'd be in communication with you. He'd know you were there. He would know that you knew he was there. That's for sure. And probably after a short period of time, why, you would have him all civilized very nicely. As a matter of fact, there was a Scientologist down in Kenya not too long ago. A whole tribal war blew up. Tribesmen of one part were charging against the tribes of another part, and he went out and he got them into communication with each other, and that was the end of the war. He spoiled the war just like that. Now, finding out about the other fellow is the important thing, then. Finding out about yourself is about the least. Obviously, the least profitable inquiry you could ever engage upon. Now, if you were studying Scientology to know about yourself, I hate to have to disappoint you. You're never going to find out a thing. But if you are in Scientology to find out about the other fellow, then you're going to have a tremendous lot of success, because we do know about the other fellow. And we can tell you all kinds of things about the other fellow. We can handle the other fellow. This is a solved problem with us today. So we can say that man's search, as long and as arduous as it's been, has come to a happy conclusion here in 1956, because we are doing things today with processing that we never dreamed we would ever be able to do, and all sorts of odd things. Of course, it isn't as fast yet as it ought to be. It takes hours and hours, and that sort of thing. But the places we're going and the things we're doing are quite astonishing enough to tell you about. Thank you.